This April, the small nonprofit is being sponsored by Troy Mailing. That's T-R-O-I Mailing. Friends, I've personally been using Troy's printing and mailing services for almost 5 years now. I choose them for my clients, and I chose them when I was in-house. They are great to work with, always get my brand colors right, are cost-effective, and get my mailouts to my donors on time, even during busy seasons. Call 1-866-876-4624 for a free $100 postage credit when you use promo code DONORDM1 on your next campaign. Thank you, Troy Mailing, for sponsoring the small nonprofit.
Welcome to the Small Nonprofit Podcast with down-to-earth practical advice on how to get things done in your small organization. You are going to change the world, and we can help. Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of the podcast. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Anya McGlynn.
Hello.
So, maybe this sounds familiar. You go to a conference, or you're reading an article on fundraising, or listening to a webinar, and the word that stands out the most is storytelling. You need to use stories. You need to use stories here and there and everywhere. And guess what? It's true. You really do.
Totally.
But a lot of people don't know how to tell a good story. And in fact, we see a lot of people tell stories not so well.
Yeah.
So today's interview with Vanessa Chase Lockshin is all about how to tell a good story, how to craft one in a way that you can use it for your fundraising and to build champions for your cause.
That's right. Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the things that we want to highlight today is, you know, why do we keep coming back to storytelling, and why is storytelling such a powerful tool? And I think it really comes back to a deeply rooted connection between ourselves as a species, the way that we form cultures, the way that we create societies, the way that we form bonds, and that's all connected to storytelling. If I can geek out for a second, Cindy, if you'll indulge me.
Absolutely.
Back in my academic days, when I was doing my doctorate, I had the very fortunate pleasure to study with Ted Chamberlain at U of T, who's an amazing theorist on oral storytelling. And he reminded us that the oldest written text is only about 6,000 years old. But as a species, we've been around for a heck of a lot longer than that, close to 50,000 years. So, you know, for a long time, we used oral storytelling to create bonds between each other. So, the way that storytelling differs from written text is when you think, imagine that you could never look something up. Like, imagine that.
Life, right? Without the internet?
Life without a book, right?
Or
life
an
without
an encyclopedia.
Exactly.
Our age, yeah.
Exactly. So that would really change the way that you would think about communicating with somebody, because everything you would tell them, they would have to remember, right? So you would start telling stories with the very express purpose of making them memorable. And as a listener, you wouldn't listen passively. You would listen with the ear of retelling.
Which is so relevant to fundraising, because really what we want with our donors and our champions is for them to remember the stories and share them, right? That is how things go, as everyone wants, viral, is when they are so deeply connected to that story and it's so memorable and compelling that they can't help but retell it to someone else.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you were talking about that too in terms of the brain.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Our brain is set up so that when we hear language, the languaging processing part of our brain lights up. That's kind of a no-brainer. But when we hear a story and we're engaged in listening to a story, the part of our brain that lights up is actually the part that's telling your body you are in that story. You are the subject of that story.
Absolutely.
And it's so powerful when we think of how we can engage our supporters in caring about the work that we're doing and becoming champions. Stories make very clear sense as a winner.
Absolutely. No, I think, you know, we all have had the experience of reading to a story or listening to a story and having the whole world around you just kind of melt away.
Totally
and the
disappear.
The only thing that's there is that story that you're reading or that story that you're listening to. And that's the kind of communication that we hope that you start to think about sending out to your donors. Stats and stories are all really, really important, and they have their place in impact reports and in final, you know, in annual reports and all that kind of stuff. But they're very, very different than a story that has one of your clients at its heart or one of your staff members at its heart, and that encourages your donor to connect with you from a heart-centered place and not just necessarily with that sort of rational part of their brain.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned, we see a lot of organizations struggle with storytelling. So on that note, I'm going to introduce the interview with Vanessa Chase Lockshin. She is an award-winning entrepreneur and consultant, and she teaches nonprofits how to tell stories that raise money and awareness. She literally wrote the book on storytelling for nonprofits called The Storytelling Nonprofit, A Practical Guide to Telling Stories That Raise More Money and Awareness. She's helped her clients raise millions of dollars, build monthly giving programs. She has donor stewardship plans, digital strategies, help retention rates, and on and on. She really is one of the thought leaders in the space, but more than a thought leader, a practitioner, which is what we love, because it's all about the practice.
Totally.
So without further ado, here's the interview. Vanessa, welcome. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your expertise in storytelling.
Absolutely. And thanks so much for having me, Cindy. So my name is Vanessa Chase Lockshin, and I'm the president of the Storytelling Nonprofit, which is a training and consulting company that works with organizations to help them tell stories that raise money and awareness. And I've been doing this work for 5 years now as a consultant. But prior to that, I was a fundraiser who was just really passionate about figuring out how to best connect with donors and how to help them understand the kind of impact they could have through giving. And that was sort of what sparked my interest in storytelling as a communications methodology.
Fantastic. I know that we hear about the importance of storytelling all the time in our sector, but we see so many organizations not do it quite well enough. So I'd love to hear from you some of the biggest mistakes you see people make and why a good story can actually help you raise more money.
Yeah, I think it's such a good point because, you know, you're right. We do hear from, you know, experts and other organizations all the time that, you know, storytelling is a good idea. And, you know, organizations will try it sometimes with some success, sometimes hoping that it's going to be like the magic bullet to fix all problems, which is not usually the case. But for organizations basically kind of stumbling with it or trying it and just not quite figuring out how to like move the right levers within the story or within the type of communication they're doing, it usually boils down to one of two problems. They either don't have a good enough understanding of their audience to tell the right story at the right time, and so there's this kind of missing component of understanding who they're telling the story to. And then the other problem I see organizations running into is just not having a good, clear, compelling explanation of what it is they're trying to do. And I think that falls under the umbrella of messaging. And you know, for a lot of organizations, they feel like their work is really complicated. Like they've got to use technical, jargony terms to figure out how to explain what they're doing in a sophisticated, smart, professional-sounding way. And the detriment of that is that when they use that as an approach to explaining what they do, they often lose the audience in the process. People have to kind of fill in the blanks themselves or think about what it is the organization is trying to tell them. And by not having that great explanation in place as kind of a foundational message, people just don't really get what they're trying to say. And if that's not in place, no story, no matter how good it might be, can solve the problem in fundraising.
Yeah, I actually just edited a story for an appeal for an organization, and it was full of all these terms and program references and different names they call things. And I cut all of it out because no one understands that except for the staff. And so tell us about that clear messaging and what can organizations do to start to put themselves not in their shoes, but in their donor and audience shoes.
Yeah, I mean, I have a fairly simple framework for thinking about it. you know, I think maybe it seems it's deceivingly simple, but I always think that having a solid fundraising message comes down to three things, which is, you know, what is it that you're, what's the problem you're trying to solve? How are you actually going to solve it? And why does making a donation help support solving that problem? And I always say those three things because if donors don't understand, you know, what the basic problem is, the sort of villain of the story or what have you, or the problem in the story, if they don't understand kind of some basic proposed solution for how you're going to solve that, and also why donating is the best way to help support that solution, there's just not enough information sometimes for people to feel compelled to donate. And oftentimes I see organizations really missing that middle piece, the how, where they kind of just jump to, you know, make a donation to make an impact in the community or to give the gift of hope, or there's some very like flowery, not substantial language used that doesn't really mean much to a donor at this point. Like, I think a lot of people are becoming desensitized to that language. And so I always encourage people to be specific, tangible, and just kind of like clear and concise in what they're trying to communicate.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of organizations, they think about that and they're like, well, that just seems so boring to just say what we're going to do. It's like, but that's what you need to do. That's what people need to understand. And sometimes that's a better approach than trying to win a Pulitzer Prize for your copywriting skills.
Yeah. I mean, I think your solution is simple, and simplicity is also the answer, which is it doesn't have to be complicated. People don't want complicated. They want to feel good about giving, and a simple, compelling story does that, right? It's not about making things, you know, systemic and complicated. And of course we want systemic change, but people react from a place of clear and concise.
And I think the how can certainly speak to systemic change. You know, for instance, I worked with a rape crisis center in Vancouver for a number of years, and a lot of their underlying message related to their vision, which was a world where women were free from violence, which definitely has a big systemic undertone to it, systemic change undertone, which is great. And that was a vision I think a lot of people could really support and get behind. And so for them, when they talked about the how, which was a lot of times, you know, their approach to counseling, which was this sort of feminist inclusive model of counseling, I was like, well, you know, part of us developing a world free from violence is also offering women healing so that they can move out of that cycle of violence that they may have experienced. And, you know, the other part of it is also doing outreach and doing advocacy to increase awareness about this kind of systemic issue. And, you know, so being able to frame both of those pieces sometimes in their appeals was very helpful to have donors understand the connection to the systemic piece, where there's both an immediate solution or thing that needs to happen to support women, and also this like larger context piece that they're working on. And, you know, here's how all those things fit together.
Absolutely. I see a lot of organizations also struggle with the how. With the why. So two scenarios I see. One is that they're organizations that are founded on the idea of giving things. So, you know, we collect clothing and donate it. Or there's a great organization here in Toronto that collects menstrual products and distributes them. And they really struggle with how to say, okay, we need your products, but we also need your money. And that's something I see a lot of organizations are challenged with. How does that fit into that story?
Yeah, I can relate to that. Years ago, when I worked for a social service organization, that was a challenge we had, which was this balance of gift and kind giving, which is the kind of product that you're talking about, versus like the cash donation of people actually making a gift the other way. And it's challenging. And I think what's interesting, or at least what I found, is that the donors that tend to give, you know, either gift and kind or cash donations tend to be very distinct, like segments of the population. Like people who are giving a gift in kind are often people who like want to make a difference, and they want to actually do something and not just like make a cash donation. They want to participate in the process a little bit more. And so they've like collected things, they purchased product, whatever, like that's been part of what they wanted to do. And, you know, people who give a cash donation, like, maybe don't have the time. Maybe that's just their preference. They believe in what the organization has proposed, and they feel like, yes, me making, you know, a $20 donation is like the best way for me to support this. And, you know, I think just going back to your question, Cindy, which is like, how do those two things fit into this question? I think, you know, for organizations that are looking to move more into cash-based donations rather than just in-kind donations, it's about developing a new narrative that helps the donor community understand the impact that that cash donation can have. And what is the difference of giving us that versus giving us the product? And how can this be maybe more impactful or just impactful in a different way, and getting people sort of brought up to speed on that?
Excellent. I want to come back to that new narrative, but before we do, the other area I see a lot of people struggle with around the why is that they actually have too many ways that people can contribute. So they, again, we just edited this letter where there was, you know, you can donate cash, you can volunteer your time, you can follow us on social media, this, that, and the other. And there's so many different calls to action in one request that it gets diluted, and it almost reinforces what I see a lot of organizations struggle with, which is like, we really don't want to ask for money because it's uncomfortable.
Right.
And so tell me how stories can actually be a tool to sort of make people more comfortable or help give them the freedom to ask more confidently for money. And then, of course, how do we deal with those multiple calls to action?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in saying that having all those calls to action just really dilutes the ability for that CTA to be very effective for a donor. You know, in terms of, you know, how does a story make us more confident in asking, or how does it kind of flex that muscle for organizations that feel, you know, a little timid or shy about putting, you know, a request out there to a donor audience? I think that in telling a story, there's like a couple of benefits, like layers to it that I see. But one is that, you know, as you tell a compelling story, you're sort of naturally building the case for why you need the donation. And in the process of doing that, you're connecting with donors, I think, on a very values level and values-based level, and also an emotional level, which are two very powerful factors in giving, where people can relate to a set of values that your organization has, that the story reflects, and that by them donating, they can sort of enact that value as well through their philanthropy. And then, of course, the other piece, you know, is the emotional component of a story, which, you know, it certainly depends on the type of story you're telling and the organization. But I think, you know, sharing emotional experiences, life experiences, are ways that people can connect and build empathy with what's going on and feel, again, like called to do something about it and really kind of understand the urgency and necessity of doing something in response to this story and the problem that it presents. Mm-hmm. And so I think my sense is that all of those things kind of coupled together is what helps kind of build that case for support and make it so much easier to just tell a story and get people engaged in that story and kind of lean into the ask a little bit easier, rather than just throwing a lot of information at people, you know, statistics and, you know, factual information, and hoping that that's enough for them to say yes and make a donation at the end of it.
Definitely. In my experience, I also find the more that staff use stories and communicate their stories, they become a lot more confident because they are reinforced that they're not asking for themselves, and they kind of, in the moment, remember their reason and their passion for the work. And I feel like that's the more personal the story can be to the person telling it, the easier it becomes to fundraise.
I think that's true. Yeah. And in one model of storytelling that I particularly like that was developed by Marshall Ganz, who's a professor at Harvard University, he has a model called public narrative. One of the stories in that model is called Story of Self, where you really talk about your own involvement in this and what sort of called you to get involved and why you're involved. And being able to speak, I think, from that level of personal experience is both easier because it's a story that you know best. Like, it's not one that you've had to memorize in order to tell someone. You've lived it, you know it, you can share it with people, I think with a certain degree of confidence. And I think also that just that idea of personal narrative, again, is like what people connect with, whether it's someone's story in a letter or whether you're talking with them face to face as a staff member, that personal narrative and what it's able to communicate is, you know, what can bring people together and help them see that they all care about this thing and they all want to, you know, find a solution to making the world a better place through this organization.
Yeah, definitely. So that brings us kind of back to this idea of what makes a story good, or how do you start? Where do you start? Let's say you are listening, you're a small organization, you have an aha moment where you're like, okay, we're not doing this right. Where can someone start to think about crafting that narrative, and what inputs need to go into that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So for me, there's kind of three pieces, and I can speak to all of these. And I mentioned two of them earlier, but there's, you know, the audience, the message, and then the actual structure and delivery of this story. And so I always think audience and message are just two really key and often overlooked components. And I feel like I often beat the drum on this about how important they are. But they really are so necessary for an organization to tell something that's both compelling and resonant to their particular audience. And I know a lot of your listeners are smaller organizations, but there's still ways to understand who your audience is, whether it's through surveys or other kind of analytics or data you might have access to. Taking the time to get to know who they are and why they care about your cause is really useful information. And I cannot underscore it enough for organizations who are doing really any kind of fundraising or communications work.
Yeah. And I often encourage organizations, if they feel like a quiz is over or a survey is overwhelming or anything like that, like pick up the phone and book a coffee and just get to know your supporters. Doesn't matter if they're giving $100 or $1,000, having those conversations and getting out in front of them gives a face to that audience, right? We're all trying to create that avatar. Well, you can actually sit across from that avatar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And when I worked in higher education, we always talked about it in terms of like going on listening tours and spending time with donors and just listening to them. But yeah, there's definitely lots of ways you can facilitate that, whether it's just through, you know, even making thank you phone calls to donors too is an opportunity to get to know them.
Yeah.
And so it's just about thinking about those little things you can do to just know your audience a little bit better. But I think knowing that audience allows you to like maneuver into the right message for that audience. You know, and thinking about, you know, the timeliness of it, the seasonality of it, the urgency of it can help you craft the right kind of moment for people to donate in and create that perfect storm of, I think, information and circumstance that people feel like, yes, now is the time to do something about this. This is a great use of my money and a great use of my resources to support this thing this organization is working on. Mm-hmm. And when you have those two things in place, I think it then becomes a lot easier to identify what story you actually want to tell. And I know a lot of organizations will try to like work the other direction and start with a story first, which I see works sometimes, but I think the challenge a lot of them run into is trying to then manipulate the story to fit for the audience and the message, whereas I think having those other two things in place first is a little bit more valuable. And so when you know the message, what you can then do is, you know, look internally in your organization and think about, you know, what stories do you have that will best help you convey this message to the audience, you know, you want to reach. And so does this need to be a story about a client or a story about a staff member or, you know, maybe even a story about a donor who gave recently to support this project? Who is sort of the best messenger for this message and can help us really effectively communicate that to the audience? Mm-hmm. And I would add that as you think about the story itself and the structure, I teach kind of a 5-part story structure to our students and clients that includes connection, character, conflict, call to action, or resolution, and then call to action. And I find that those 5 pieces of the story really well help organizations build the case, as I said, kind of in a progressing natural way as they write an email or write a direct mail letter, where they are, you know, giving people context and building connection with them. They're introducing them to, you know, a character. And I use that loosely because it could be a person, it could be, you know, more of an abstract concept who's sort of the character of that story. You're introducing a problem and helping donors see like, this is a need, and framing it as like, this is something that's happening. And maybe it's not just unique to this one person or this one set of people. And then showing that there's a way to resolve this. Like, what is your organization proposing we do about this? How is that unique or different from what other organizations are doing? How is this really going to move the needle forward on an issue, systemic or otherwise? Thinking about those questions can be really valuable. And then coming to the actual call to action, which I think, as you very rightly pointed out earlier, is most effective when you're able to just have that one really strong call to action and not water it down with too many options for people in the process.
Mm-hmm. In my experience, actually extracting a story. So let's say you have a really great subject, and you most organizations will have to actually sit down and interview that person. And that's also quite a specific skill set. And I found that the subjects will often tell you what they think you want them to say instead of what you need them to say to tell a good story. Do you have any advice around interviewing or extracting that valuable content to build a compelling story?
Yes. And I think that's a really good point, which is that interviews can be very tricky. I think both for the person who you're interviewing and for the person who is doing the interviewing. So I know from my experience with working with fundraising staff, oftentimes they feel very nervous. They're not sure what to ask. It's this kind of like weird dance to interview someone. And the mistake I often see fundraisers make in that context is sitting down with someone and just saying, you know, so tell me your story, like what's going on, and like, tell me what I need to know, basically. And I always say that's like the least effective question you can ask, because no one is sitting there thinking like, this is the story I need to tell. You know, like very few people are thinking that way. And it's also kind of a very big, broad question that can feel overwhelming. Like, how do you do justice to something you've experienced? Like, can you do justice to it in this context? And I think instead, what's a better approach to that process is to think about it as a conversation, and to think about it as just getting to know someone. And I think every time I've approached it that way, I've been able to get much more authentic, interesting information out of the process, and actually build the story in a much, I think, less, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a less pressured and manufactured way. Like, I'm not necessarily getting information from people that they think I want to hear. Instead, they're telling me things that they genuinely experienced and things that they went through. And I think, you know, another part of, I think, the art of interviewing people is often your ability to be present and ask the small, insightful follow-up questions. You know, like, how were you feeling when that happened? Or tell me more about that. Or what happened? Or why did you choose to do this specific thing? And oftentimes those questions are great to just kind of dive into it a little more and give you a little bit more insight to the nuances of what someone experienced.
Yes, I'm standing here nodding my head because I always say the number one quality that makes a good fundraiser great is curiosity. And I see a lot of people come to those interviews with like a set of questions, and they just read one after the other after the other. And it's those little questions that the nudges, the, you know, extraction of more information and curiosity and engagement that really, I agree, takes the story from something that's more robotic and testimonial-like to something that's emotional and compelling.
Yeah, definitely. And I can also share too, you know, in a class I teach called the Storytelling Nonprofit Masterclass, one of the things I really emphasize with students in there is that it's not about just showing up and like hoping things will go well. Like the answer to being overprepared is not being prepared at all. Like there's definitely a happy medium there. And I think it's valuable to like do your research and understand like who it is you're going to talk to, like what they've maybe been through. You know, I think it especially in situations where there may have been trauma that someone has healed or is working on healing, you know, what are some potential landmines in that conversation that you may want to steer clear of? Like, there's all kinds of things you can think of to make it a really good experience for the person you're interviewing. And I often say to our students, you know, it's good to come with, you know, maybe three or four questions that are just sort of broad guiding questions that you think will be helpful to lead the conversation and unravel the story a little bit. But it's really just about being present and engaging in the conversation and just following it where it goes and trying to use that more as a guide than trying to force certain types of information out of the conversation.
Definitely. You brought up another point, which is the idea of trauma or working with vulnerable populations. And I know a lot of the small charities in Canada, which are who are our audience, work around social justice and work with organizations, or sorry, work with client populations who have experienced trauma or who are healing or where there is an issue of power dynamics. And that can be really uncomfortable and scary for the organization or not want to reinforce traditional hierarchies. So how would organizations sort of navigate that space in a way that still feels true and authentic to their values?
Mm-hmm. I often say the best person to tell a story is the one who's really ready to share it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true. Like your organization and, you know, program staff may see people go through, you know, a program or a service you have and may think that that person has a really interesting story to share. And that may very well be true. But if that person is not feeling comfortable sharing that story, then it's not a good situation to put them in. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, staff have to kind of, I think, be advocates for the people they work with and, you know, think about, is this really a good situation? Do we feel like we've given them enough information to make or have informed consent about what we're asking them to do? And, you know, have we really thought about the ramifications for this? Like, are there potential implications? You know, would sharing this story in the media potentially have like consequences for this person? You know, I think about that in the context of like the work that I did with a rape crisis center, where it was like, of course, we had really interesting, very powerful stories to share, but women were always at different points in their healing journey. Many might want to share their story. Many do not want to share their story, and that's totally fine. There's a level of autonomy and agency that's important to give them, mm-hmm. And never making them feel sort of forced into it. I think that's the thing I see a lot of organizations trying to like navigate around, which is that, you know, they know clients are grateful and happy for service or experiences they had. And they don't want them to feel manipulated into having to like share a story out of this like sense of gratitude or being indebted to the organization. That's like not a good place to go for anyone. And so a lot of it is just about being able to have honest conversations with the person who you're interested in having tell their story. And, you know, being very clear and upfront about, you know, what it is you think the process will be like, you know, what to expect from it. You know, I think for people who have experienced trauma, saying, you know, like, we would like to interview you and talk about this thing you've been through, you know, how are you feeling about that? Like, is that bringing up anxiety for you thinking about talking about it? You know, will you have resources available if it gets triggering or if it gets complicated? Like, you know, could we have like, you know, a staff member who work closely with you be there to support you? You know, could we support you afterwards? You know, maybe the experience of telling that story was very, you know, emotionally draining or taxing for someone. You know, is there, you know, a social worker or someone on staff who could meet with them afterwards to talk about it and debrief and kind of help them just like feel a little bit more resilient and supported in that process? And so I think those are nice things that staff can do to be thoughtful about it and mindful. Yeah. And, you know, I can share my own experience. You know, I went through a pretty major accident 2 years ago and I had PTSD after that. And it was, I think I went through a lot of ebbs and flows about sharing what I went through, even with just family and friends on a certain level. And there were definitely times during that where it was like, well, like, you know, I'm not at all equipped to talk about this with people. And having like been through that process myself and being on the other side of it, I'm like, oh yeah, exactly. Like when people are going through something big, like that is not the time for them to publicly process it. Mm-hmm. They need space to figure out what they're going through, to like have their own process to heal. And when they're on the other side, when they're feeling well-resourced, when they're feeling resilient, then maybe is a better time for them to engage in that like public dialogue about something they went through.
Amazing. Yeah, I think that's so important for organizations. It's often a barrier to even starting to tell stories in a meaningful way, but you've given really practical advice on how to overcome those barriers in a respectful and values-driven way. So thank you.
Absolutely.
So the other barrier I see for a lot of organizations is the idea that there is not enough time and they just can't get everything done. And, you know, it's so great. Yeah. You know, we love stories, but you're telling me I have to sit down and interview and collect and, you know, how many stories do I even need? And so what advice do you have in terms of to organizations that don't have a lot of resources, how can they still collect and use stories? I mean, how many stories do you need? How can you repurpose them? How do we overcome that constant pressure of not having enough time?
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is a problem that organizations face in like a multitude of ways of like, where is the line of enough so that, you know, a project or initiative doesn't become, you know, this like ungodly behemoth that's like taking over the organization. Yeah. Which I think this like very well can be the case for a lot of organizations. You know, with fundraising, if goals aren't clearly defined, it's like you're just like you keep doing and doing and doing. And I think the same can be true with storytelling, where it's like if you don't have clear kind of vision for what it is you're doing with these stories, you know, there's a sense that, you know, it's just very nebulous and you're not really sure what to do or like how much to keep doing and all of that. I often tell organizations that are getting started or trying to figure out what to do, this doesn't have to be something that you like dive into the deep end of where you are becoming like a story machine and just like constantly telling stories. There's something to be said for having quality stories and maybe having fewer of them that you could share in a variety of ways. And I think that's another important point to emphasize, which is that even if you share a story once, you know, in a fundraising email or direct mail appeal or, you know, even like a social media post, the chances that enough people have seen that to respond to it are actually very slim. And so there's a way in which even if you only have, you know, one or two stories, you can keep repurposing them and reusing them and re-exposing your audience to them to continue to communicate that message. And I would add with a caveat that as you keep doing that, you know, just monitor and see, like, are you still getting good results from this story, or has it kind of reached the end of its life cycle of being effective? Mm-hmm. But I think that can be a way that organizations can, you know, engage in storytelling in a much more manageable way that doesn't feel like another very large thing on their to-do list.
Absolutely. I used to work at an organization that had an annual event, and every year we would roll our eyes because they would use the same speech, maybe change a couple stats, change the story, but everything else would be word for word the same. Yeah. But no one was the wiser because they don't remember what you said last year. So we get sick of certain content because we see it all the time, but that's not how people engage with the content from the outside. So,
oh, absolutely. And it's funny because in some respects, you know, staff members are like the worst judge, like whether you've hit the line of too much around sharing a message or a story, because you've spent hours with it. Like you wrote the thing, you've been working on it, like you've seen it way too often. And yet like your audience has maybe only seen it once or twice. And so, you know, there's like a very big difference in perception between those two groups.
Definitely. I kind of laugh because I have someone I work with, one of our clients, who does that with jokes. So they'll make the same joke over and over again, but to someone different. But because I'm always sitting there with them in the meetings, I've heard the same joke 100 times, right? Right. But it's still funny because for the other people, it's their first time hearing it. So yeah. We definitely have a different perspective on what's happening than people who don't see it every day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Excellent. Vanessa, I feel like we covered so much in a very short period of time. Are there any other sort of common pitfalls that fall outside of that structure of audience, compelling message, and the structure of your story? Things that you see organizations do that, you know, they can tweak and improve in a really straightforward way.
Yeah, I mean, I think you talked about this a little earlier on, but just that idea of having a clear explanation of what it is you're doing. You know, so often I think organizations do not figure out, like, cannot or have not figured out a good way of characterizing and bottom lining what it is that's going on and, you know, why they're asking for money, what it is they need help with, and why donating is a good idea. And so being able to characterize things is very helpful, and having a good way of talking about them is very valuable. So I think that sometimes it just comes down to me, anyways, this very basic concept of figuring out good ways of talking about what it is you're doing and having that useful, clear, concise language to figure out ways to just communicate what it is your organization is working on. And I think that has the benefit of trickling into, you know, your stories, the appeals, everything else you may work on, and helping you be much clearer in what it is you're trying to say to your audience. And hopefully that translates into more people taking action because they also understand what's going on.
Amazing. Well, I would say whenever you're in doubt around what to say about your organization, tell a story. So on that note, where can our listeners get more information about the resources you have for small charities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a great place to start is over on my website, which is thestorytellingnonprofit.com. I also have written a book called The Storytelling Nonprofit, A Practical Guide to Telling Stories That Raise Money and Awareness, which is available on Amazon.ca and Amazon.com. And it's a very practical, hands-on workbook for figuring out how to tell great stories about your organization. So that's also a very accessible place for small charities to start with storytelling.
Amazing. Vanessa, thank you on behalf of all of our listeners. We really appreciate your time and great pieces of wisdom that are really practical for our audiences. So
thank you so much, Cindy. It's great to be here.
Thanks. Well, folks, that's it for today's episode of The Small Nonprofit. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and this show is brought to you by The Good Partnership. As a reminder, if you want more resources around raising more money for your small nonprofit, visit thegoodpartnership.com and download our free fundraising strategy guide. I'll see you next week.